You're listening to a 3CR podcast of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia.
Radio MMT respectfully acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land from which we are broadcasting, the Wurundjeri people, and we are broadcasting to the Kulin nations. Our focus is economics, that is, how stuff is produced and distributed. We recognise that for many tens of thousands of years, First Nations people's connection to country successfully embodied the world's oldest continuous economy, which was catastrophically disrupted by genocide and displacement. We acknowledge that we have much to learn to reshape our current extractive and exploitive system to achieve sustainable prosperity for everyone.
Radio MMT. Economics for the rest of us with Anne
and Kev.
Radio MMT.
Looking at the world through the lens of modern monetary theory.
Radio MMT.
Macroeconomics for a well-being economy.
Macroeconomics? Like, isn't that incredibly boring?
No, Kevin, it's incredibly interesting. It's all about who gets what and why.
Who gets what and why? Okay, I'm in.
Radio MMT at gmail.com.
Incredibly interesting macroeconomics for the rest of us. Welcome to Radio MMT. How are you this week, Anne?
Hey, Kevin. I'm doing well, and hello to our lovely listener. Thank you for joining us once again as Kevin and I take a look at this thing called the economy and how it is relying on a monetary system to be an economy.
Yeah, and this week we're delving into what exactly is a monetary system. And it's interesting because we're born into these things, everything's taken for granted, and we never look objectively of what environment that we're in. So we're going to try and be objective, try and be like a Martian.
Well, in our effort to do that, Kevin, we are going to hear a conversation that you and I had with Brett Scott. Now, Brett has dabbled in the dark arts of the fintech sector. Brett is a systems thinker. And, you know, even though you and I have started to wake up to the fact that we live in a monetary system, they can be pretty hard to describe because they are inherently complex and they have all these interacting parts. And Brett is one of those people who's found ways for describing monetary and finance systems to someone who really doesn't usually spend a lot of time thinking about this stuff.
And it's important to understand what the monetary system is, especially from an MMT point of view, because we have this battle going on about, is money an invention of the private sector that originated from barter, and we call that the barter myth, or is money an instrument of government? Now, Brett doesn't go specifically into this, but it's important to keep in the back of your mind that we're defining money because that impacts on how the economy runs at a very fundamental, basic level.
And people who've listened to Radio MMT before might realise that you and I do love a good metaphor. And Brett Scott is the king of metaphors. I think that's one reason why he's so successful at explaining monetary systems to the average money user. So why don't we have a listen now to our conversation with Brett Scott, economic anthropologist, about monetary systems. I am so pleased to be able to speak with Brett Scott today. Welcome to Radio MMT, Brett.
Great. Great to be here.
So, Brett, I mostly know you through your articles on your Substack, which is fantastically named Altered States of Monetary Consciousness. And I know you through your book, Cloud Money, Why the War on Cash Endangers Our Freedom. And that was published in 2022. And I've also seen you described as a campaigner, a monetary anthropologist, and a former broker. And of course, I also think of you as a writer and educator as well, with your very accessible visuals and essays. So I was wondering, could you tell us a bit of the Brett Scott story with a view to how you got interested in monetary systems and even what part MMT, modern monetary theory, might have played?
Sure. Well, I'm from South Africa. So I grew up the tail end of apartheid in South Africa. So, you know, in a sort of fascist police state, essentially. And that probably had some impact on me. I guess I was confused about society at some level as a kid. And so at some level, I was kind of drawn towards anthropology, which, you know, is an academic discipline that tries to understand how cultural groups work. And historically, anthropologists have this technique of going into different groups and trying to understand the internal dynamics of those groups. And actually, anthropology also has quite an interesting and rich tradition of thinking about economic systems. Because bear in mind, you know, economists, that discipline was forming in, you know, like the sort of 1800s and stuff. And it was forming inside European cities. And so economists, what they were imagining as sort of universal principles were actually just European city principles. Right. Because, you know, if the fish can't see the water that it's in, you know, economists are just like, well, I just assume that everything's just trade and like money and stuff. They just sort of take that stuff for granted. And then they would sort of build their models from that perspective. But anthropologists during colonial times, you know, even if they were coming from those European settings and stuff, were actually forced to encounter ways of being that didn't map easily onto, you know, standard economics ways of thinking about the world. So actually, anthropology tends to have a much stronger tradition of thinking about money, right? Because they were forced to encounter pre-capitalist groups. For example, in South Africa, in the 1800s, the, you know, mining authorities, the sort of colonial groups, would literally say things like, to make the Xhosa pastoralists, you know, work in the mines, demand taxation from them in coins, because they have no desire to be working in the mines, because they are they're not proletarian urban working class. They like live in the mountains and herd cattle, and they don't want to work for money. Right, so like literally force them to pay tax, so they'll be forced into the wage labor markets to essentially give kind of tribute to the sort of state corporate complex in South Africa. And that's like documented. You can see it.
That's a very stark example of the MMT money story.
Yeah, exactly. And in Europe, that's much harder to see because that sort of process goes way further back. Whereas in places like South Africa, you could just literally just see it straight in front of you, like in the 1800s. So anthropology has a long tradition of kind of like looking at some of these types of dynamics. So I studied anthropology. And then I guess in that tradition, I became very interested in the financial sector and studied in the UK for a bit. And I saw how powerful the financial sector was. Goldman Sachs and these big financial players were like hanging around the universities there, trying to sort of suck people in to the system. And so I became very sort of darkly fascinated about like what's going on in the world of high finance. And I actually ended up going to work in the financial sector for 2 years or so. But it was very much in the spirit of the sort of anthropological exploration of things. So I find it very fascinating. It was quite an alien world for me, but I was treating it very much like a kind of adventure of some sort. And so I learned a bunch about so-called high finance, right? The kind of large-scale finance processes.
You went in willingly. You went in to experience it.
A bit more like gonzo journalism or something, where you're sort of half trying to actually be in it to sort of get the emotional feeling of it. Because I was like, let me go into this thing that I find actually quite repugnant at some level and see like what it kind of does to me. You know, I'm very left wing, right, in my approach to many things. But, you know, I'm not particularly necessarily intimidated by like a finance person. I have an organic experience of that system, so I don't really feel like I'm out of my depth. Even when I don't understand what they're saying about a particular thing, like I believe that I would be able to learn it, you know. And that comes from just that immersion process. You sort of realize that actually that the financial sector is full of people who don't really know what's going on.
That's the impression we all got after the GFC, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And they're often just like random people who've drifted in there for various different reasons. And so you sort of see the more human, banal side of these types of systems. But also, for example, you realize that understanding of the monetary system is very, very low in finance.
Mm.
Most financiers aren't required to understand the monetary system. I mean, they just have to know how to like move it around.
It's a constant comment when you tell people that you're involved in economics and they sort of think, oh, what sort of shares should I buy? You know, I understand the systems, but I don't know how to make money. I just understand where it comes from.
We talk about money, but we don't have much of it, do we, Kev?
No.
It's a bit like, you know, maybe with surfers, they know how to ride waves, but they don't necessarily understand like oceanic physics. You know, but in reality, those things might have impacts on the waves that they're riding.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a similar thing in finance or even, like, you know, entrepreneurialism and stuff. Your skill set is like, how do you ride the random wave that's coming towards you? You're not supposed to necessarily like care or understand about what's driving it.
Yep, that makes sense.
We like a good analogy on this show. So are there any more dots to join between you doing your immersion into the world of finance and then where you are now with writing about and I think being very active around monetary systems?
Yeah, I guess I got thrown out of the financial sector at some point and I wrote a book called The Heretic's Guide to Global Finance, which was a guide for activists. So it came in the heels of the Occupy Wall Street movement because I've been writing about finance and activism and I was asked to write this book, which was sort of just a kind of DIY guide for any activists who are looking to sort of do stuff around exploring or jamming or hacking various elements of the financial sector. So the book wasn't necessarily very deep, but it was quite sort of tactical. Like, you have a particular cause that you want to champion. Here are some ways you can kind of like mess with the financial sector. And it was quite popular among niche activist groups. But interestingly, actually, at that time, in the post-financial crisis era, lots of the tech people in the tech industry also had a self-perception that they were hacking the financial sector. They sort of imagined themselves as being sort of slightly heroic figures disrupting the big players, right? And so I started getting invited into these kind of tech circles, and then I became interested as like, what's going on in the tech sector?
Mm-hmm.
I realized that a lot of the fintech world, the financial technology world, tech meets finance stuff, you know, they imagined themselves as democratizing finance and stuff, but in reality, they were just automating finance. They were just trying to make the same toxic system just faster, basically, and easier to use.
Mm.
So that actually led up to my latest book, Cloud Money, which looks at the intersection of big tech and big finance.
Mm-hmm.
And cloud money also looks at how that manifests as a sort of ideological attack against the cash system, so the physical component of the state money system.
Mm.
And so all the kind of anti-cash ideology that accompanies automation processes. Yeah, so all my new work is kind of following on from there, you know. Asimoko, or Altered States of Monetary Consciousness, my Substack, sort of is building out a whole bunch of different tracks from there.
Well, we'll definitely link to that in the show notes, as they say. And I highly recommend people follow you on that one because it is a fascinating read.
You're listening to 3CR 855 AM on digital and on the internet. www.3cr.org.au.
That was independent thinker Brett Scott. No, it's ironic, isn't it, Kevin, how everyone is interested in money, but even if they hate money, very few people get into what monetary systems are.
Yeah, well, coming at it from an anthropological, is that the right word?
Yeah.
Anthropological viewpoint as opposed to an economic viewpoint. Mm. He's looking essentially at human behavior, especially when he was mentioning the cattle herders who didn't want to become part of the monetary system. So the government used taxation as a way of affecting their behavior so that they did the things that the government wanted them to do as opposed to operating independently. And monetary systems don't like other systems operating alongside. They like to be all-encompassing, and they don't want solo players out there operating outside their system. They need to drag everybody in.
Oh, I don't know about that. I think in our modern Western lifestyles, we live in and out of the monetary system, you know, getting our needs met without using money. Like, you know, you look after each other's kids or whatever it is.
Yeah, there are some social behaviours that are still there, but the amount of time that people spend having to earn money these days just to put a roof over their head, it's all kind of surrounded in the monetary system.
Yeah, but I don't blame monetary systems for that. I blame the way they're implemented and the way the finance sector has distorted the monetary system so it works in its favour, particularly for, you know, the banks.
But what we take out of this is that money seems to be as much, if not more, about controlling behaviour than it does about the exchange of goods or mobilising resources. It's like you need to be doing this work because we don't regard your cattle herding as useful. We need you to be in the mines instead. So we're going to change what you do by imposing a tax on you. And that's a really good explanation of how MMT regards tax as an enforcer of the currency. Mm. But you see it affects people's behaviour. And certainly, look, I know from my own experience as a self-employed person that I need to keep on working because I know I have a tax obligation. Mm. And a lot of the work I'm doing is only there to meet this tax obligation. And I'm doing work that really, do I need to be doing this much work? I'm kind of chained to the system because of this tax obligation. And it affects behaviour. It chains you to the system.
Well, that is the whole point of a monetary system. When the economists talk about it, they say that the whole point of having a monetary system or the whole point of a government instigating a tax and then demanding that the tax be paid in the currency is so that it can mobilise resources, so that it can move resources from the private sector into the public sector. So, I mean, I suppose a mine might be public, but usually you think of, say, the military or the court system or
roads or health or, yeah,
education and so on.
Lots of things, yeah.
Yeah, so the whole point is to alter people's behaviour so that they're no longer going off and homesteading and, you know, getting their living off the land. They're, you know, moving into a city and working in one of these jobs that are part of the public service provision.
And I guess this is where the responsibility of government becomes fairly important, because if government is captured by corporate interests, and we see that in the current day with all of this talk about energy and gas, and for that work to be done, which you and I, of course, would regard as an abhorrent abuse to be facilitating this commercial interest for something which is destructive. And yet this happens. And this indicates the responsibility that government has in its use of taxation and how it ultimately pushes our behaviour around to suit its or other people's means.
Yeah, I think even that example that Breck gave where they were requiring the Indigenous population to go and work in mines, that to me is an abuse of a public utility, which is money, probably in the interests of some mining companies.
And down the chain it goes, yeah. So getting back to your point, you're saying that it's not necessarily the monetary system, it's how the monetary system is used or abused.
Mm.
And we've had this discussion quite a few times before, and I think monetary systems inherently attract an abuse of how they're used because of the way that you can accumulate wealth and power in a monetary system.
The temptation is huge.
It seems to be fairly consistent throughout history that it seems to interfere with the proper process.
I guess that's where I become an idealist, where I think monetary systems can be used for the good society.
Yes, yes. Anyway, I do like the way Brett thinks. And as you said, he's an independent thinker. I like the way his mind works and he phrases things very well, and he does like the metaphor. But
well, in that case, let's return to our conversation with economic anthropologist and author of Cloud Money, Brett Scott. Perhaps you would like to do the spiel for why should people care about monetary systems? Why do people need to even know about monetary systems?
Well, I mean, they don't have to know. I mean, most people go through their whole lives without knowing, you know. Well, for a start, at a more kind of existential level, if you want to understand what's happening around you, it's useful. At a political level, it's very useful too, because it puts you in a much better position to call out crap and stuff like that, you know. But I guess one thing I've realized of, you know, writing about money for many years is that really not everyone cares. And I've started to learn to try to accept that. You know, there's only ever going to be a particular subset of people who take a deep interest, even if I believe that everyone should take an interest. But if I was to try and articulate to somebody, I'd be like, you know, if you want to understand capitalism, you really want to understand monetary systems. Yeah, if you want to feel connected to your environment and understand the situation you're in, you want to understand these systems.
Do you think that if you want to change behavior, do you need to change something like the monetary system? Which is to say, do you think the current capitalistic monetary system is creating a particular behavior?
I mean, I'm not sure that causality works in a single direction. Like things sort of cycle and have feedbacks. I sometimes use the term co-evolution. So, well, what I would say is our current way of being, our current lives, cannot exist without a particular monetary system. So if you want to imagine a different way of life, you would probably have to imagine a different monetary system. But it's not a very straightforward connection between how those things operate. Because in reality, what actually happens is like, some ruler at some point introduces us as a kind of political innovation, then it has a whole bunch of like unexpected economic effects, and then some new system forms that they didn't intend to create, you know. And then after the fact, you can start speaking about, oh, it was designed to be like this. But that's never what's actually happening, right? We live in systems that we don't really understand how they were created, really. And so this becomes a question, if you're designing alternative monetary systems, it's like you can imagine an alternative society that would emerge if your system succeeds, but it's always tricky to know how that process is going to work.
Yeah, I guess what I'm sort of wondering about is it appears to me that the current system encourages an accumulation of wealth for the individual.
Yeah.
And when you look at some pre-colonial cultures, you know, look in Australia, they didn't have a monetary system. And I would imagine the behavior of that population operates very differently.
Very different.
There's a presumption in mainstream economics that markets are a natural thing.
Of course, yeah.
And that this is natural behavior.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, from an anthropological perspective, the basic way of approaching it would be to say that, okay, the fundamental reality of human society is, or economic systems, is interdependence. So like people don't survive by themselves. And that just stays the same throughout time. That's always a given. No matter what style of economy you're in, you're always interdependent. The question is like, what is the style of interdependence? What is the scale, etc.? So if you're looking, for example, at Aboriginal groups in Australia, you're looking at essentially small-scale groups who often have quite secure relationships between themselves and are quite stable and operate at small scale through things like what might be called informal reciprocity. Sort of your community is woven together by like these webs of credit, essentially, but it's very informal. It's very unmeasured. So a core feature of what you'd call a market actually is a very specific form of reciprocity where it's immediate, it's very formalized, it's measured. Whereas like informal reciprocity, which is something you'll find more in hunter-gatherer bands, it's often not immediate. It's often unmeasured and it's often very informal and in the background. So when you talk about the rise of markets, what you're talking about is where those types of relationships get pushed into the background and a much more explicit form of like measured formal reciprocity comes to the fore. Now that only tends to happen in very like certain situations. For example, the MMT story, and not only MMT, also like economic anthropology story. This tends to be associated with the rise of particular political groups who have the ability to start essentially scaling up economies, all right? So they'll actually take smaller groups and start to bind them together by using common credit systems. And this is why like empires and stuff at some level like, associated with the rise of like very large scale groups of people, but also the rise of monetary systems, because that's part of the way they bind those groups together, right? It's very hard to do informal reciprocity at a large scale. So when you look at a modern capitalist economy, it's basically a very large scale system that's kind of been bound together by like institutional credit systems.
That's one of the things I've seen about money is part of the power of it is to weave lots of people together in these very complex relationships.
Exactly. And that changes certain things, or it releases certain types of forces that aren't present in other societies. So for example, in a hunter-gatherer band, you're often very secure. Like you basically, you don't have to fight to be in the society.
You're not unemployed, are you?
Exactly. You're not sort of sucking up to bosses being like, hey, can I please get into the band or something? It's like, it's assumed that you're there, right? Whereas think about a teenager in a modern market society. They're essentially asked to compete to get into the interdependent structure. If they can't, they have to go back to their parents, but the parents have to have some access to that structure.
Yeah, there's always that overshadowing thing that you could end up on the streets if you don't do X, Y, and Z.
Yeah. There's no sort of exit point to the system. You have to basically compete. And if you don't, you're going to be screwed. Mm. So there's an inherent insecurity in the system. And this applies regardless of whether, you know, there's a benevolent type of democratic state at play.
Mm.
One of the dynamics with sort of the state is it underpins the monetary system that will allow that situation to take place, but then it has to decide to what extent it's going to deal with the kind of collateral damage of that process. You know, is it going to actually provide security to the unemployed? Is it going to step in and so on? You know, the whole system is characterized by essentially this kind of fluid interdependence, which has this instability in it. And you can make arguments, for example, that the growth impulse emerges from this in capitalist economies. The fact that people are inherently insecure, so they're often forced to try to over-secure their positions, which often means they're trying to win more market share, or they're trying to undercut people, and they have to constantly try to like fight to stay in the system, which will push the system towards a growth impulse. And then like the banking sector and stuff will play into that. They'll say, we also have the same inherent insecurity, and we will try to push new money into these situations where people are also trying to compete to survive.
It's a good description of the capitalist system, the fundamental insecurity that underpins it.
It's one way of describing it.
And it's the constant argument used by the conservatives that a private market will produce better results and the government should stay out of the way because of their competition.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. If you're taking seriously that all economic systems throughout time are interdependent, so you're actually talking about, at some level, a collaborative structure. And this is hard for people to imagine because they often don't think about the world like this. But when you go and buy a product off the shelf, what you're basically doing is you're connecting into that structure. You know, you're essentially collaborating with the supply chain, you know. Like, for example, the microphone you're holding right now, you perceive yourself as having bought it. So it doesn't feel collaborative, but in reality, you're actually collaborating with the supply chain that produced that.
Mm.
That's actually what's happening in a capitalist economy. You're in these vast chains of collaboration, but you often don't perceive it as a process of collaboration.
And yet the capitalist system tells people that they're on their own and that they need to compete.
Yeah. So the fundamental underlying reality, even in a capitalist system, is interdependence, but it doesn't appear to you like that. And the ideology doesn't tell you that. So for example, a conservative government will say something like, competition is good.
Mm.
All right. Basically what they're saying, if you think about it, you're holding your microphone, you're at the end of that supply chain. You took it from the whole chain of people who produced that thing. But they're saying, actually, we want to create insecurity for that chain so another chain could come in and give you that same microphone. So we want to keep them in a state of insecurity, keep them in a potential to be cut off from their customers, keep people on their toes, as it were. And this will create the fear that will lead to innovation. And then they imagine this as being the thing that will then empower consumers. Of course, the problem is that, you know, what are consumers in society? Consumers are people who work, right? It's you, right? So it's like you must be kind of slightly terrorized as a worker in order to get all these things that then are imagined to come out of competition. You know, this is very different to like, you know, Aboriginal groups. It's like, those groups are considered to be low innovation, right? But one of the reasons for that is that they're not under threat of being thrown out of the society constantly. Mm-hmm. You're not being forced to compete to be in the society, so you don't have to constantly be trying to undercut everybody. This is why those societies have a different feeling to them. Mm. So the sort of romanticized version of the capitalist story is like, oh, it's going to create all this wondrous abundance and innovation. And the dark side of that is like, well, you're going to be constantly at the risk of being cut off for your entire life.
You're with Anne and Kev on Radio MMT.
At 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia.
And wherever you get your podcasts.
Economics for the rest of us.
We're talking about like the dark side of capitalism. And of course, that implies a questioning of the system that we're in and looking for alternatives. One of the proposals you'll often hear is, let's just do away with money altogether. You know, money is the root of all evil. So I'm just wondering how you respond to proposals to do away with money, and if you have any vision of what a future society might look like if it didn't have money.
Our current world can't exist without money.
Economic anthropologist and author of Cloud Money, Brett Scott.
So like, going back to the microphone, I mean, the microphone relies upon gigantic international sort of supply chains, right? And you can't interact with those supply chains without these huge credit systems.
Mm-hmm.
So if you say something like a world without money, you're talking about a destruction of everything around you. It can't exist without this thing. It's like an organism saying, I want to get rid of my nervous system. You know, it's like, okay, well, you're going to do that, but you're not going to exist anymore, right?
Right.
So you better find an alternative nervous system before you do that. Otherwise, you're
going to find that transplant.
But this is the issue of the day, though, isn't it? Because this system that we're talking about is also headed for destruction.
Okay, so in this situation, saying something like, I want the end of the monetary system, it's an abstract statement, but I can sort of understand why somebody might say it.
Mm.
And then the question is, okay, is there some way to, using this nervous system metaphor, to sort of like regraft some kind of new nervous system into yourself? Or what would you have to do to have a different way of being? You know, you could sort of fragment. Let me use a slightly different metaphor here. I'm always at risk of mixing metaphors. This is a problem I have. But yeah, think for example about a city like Los Angeles. Los Angeles is like a vast city. The reason why Los Angeles is so big is because of the automobile industry. If you didn't have automobiles, you wouldn't have that city. The reason why a person finds it viable to live 30 kilometers away from their place of work is because automobiles exist.
Mm.
Right? If automobiles didn't exist, it would take them an entire day to walk to work 30 kilometers. So they wouldn't live that far. They'd live closer to their place of work. So Los Angeles implies automobiles. Now, if you took away automobiles, what would happen to that city? Well, it would be incredibly chaotic for a start. It would be an initial period of incredible dislocation. But at some point, it would fragment into lots of smaller places.
Mm.
People would recalibrate eventually, sort of fragment into a much smaller system.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this sometimes is the kind of vision you might find in sort of alternative economics. So like, okay, if you remove the monetary system, the economy will have to fragment into smaller pieces to deal with that. Essentially go back to these very small scale groups. And that sometimes is part of the actual vision in alternative economy groups. They won't necessarily frame it as the end of the monetary system, but they'll say something like, you know, we'll go back to local currencies. We'll try to create these sort of smaller nervous systems that don't require these vast banking sectors and stuff, right? Which allow for the sort of inequality and stuff to happen. So that's, you know, one of the types of visions that people start to push at. But of course, the thing to be thinking about in those situations is there's never any blank slate, all right? As you're building one of these alternative systems, the other system still exists. So it's going to try to like co-opt your system.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So anybody who's tried to sort of build local currencies and build smaller networks, as it were, always discovers that everybody who's in those networks is also in the much bigger one. So the person's like, well, you know, I have my day job working at the company, but sort of on the side, I'll do a bit of the alternative economy stuff. But they're still being like pulled by the logic of the other system. And this is a generic problem that'll face anybody who's trying to think about reforming.
Mm.
Interestingly, if you look at like the MMT movement, I mean, MMT doesn't have this problem because it looks at the large scale system. It's like the MMT movement isn't saying build new smaller nervous systems for the superorganism of our economy. It says take control of the existing one.
Right, right.
And turn it towards better ends, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is it's a much more large scale thing. But of course, all the types of community currency people on the side will be like, well, that's not addressing the core problem.
I disagree that MMT says that. I'd say that MMT gives clarity to somebody who is thinking along those lines.
Sure. Yeah, I suppose there's a descriptive and there's a prescriptive side to MMT. On the descriptive side of it, where it's just describing the monetary system, it's more just a kind of like, this is how it actually operates. But there is an implicit politics to it, which is there's a reason why it's being redescribed.
Yeah.
Yeah, MMT does take you up to that nation state level. And it's kind of interesting to think about local currencies because, of course, you don't have to get very far into the weeds of alternative thinking around monetary systems before you do stumble upon groups who are looking at local currencies. And I can really understand the attraction when you're seeing in your community that you've got these unused resources, you've got these unmet needs, and the way we understand to put those together is through a currency. So I'm just wondering if you've come across any successful attempts at local currencies, or what would you say would be the characteristics for a successful alternative currency system?
I mean, it depends on what your objective is, right? There is no sort of single metric. I mean, if the objective is to replace the entire monetary system, there are no successful examples. But if it's like something like, you know, we want to create a perception of a local economy, that's one type of objective. So I used to work on something called the Brixton Pound in the UK, in London, in a neighborhood called Brixton. And the Brixton Pound, for all intents and purposes, is basically a British pound ring-fenced into a smaller area.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a voucher, essentially. So, you know, like if Woolworths issues a voucher, it's basically saying, you know, you handed us Australian dollars and we issued you a IOU in response that says you can now use this within the confines of our system. It's like a ring-fenced Australian dollar with the Woolworths branding on it.
Mm.
Now, a local currency is often the same thing. It's just you hand British pounds, for example, they put it into a bank account and issue a voucher with different branding on it. And that's accepted by certain types of merchants. So that's like a voucher-based local currency. Now, the objective of something like that might be, you know, we want to try and keep the sort of economic energy in a smaller area. And by limiting the redeemability of this thing, we can do that.
Right.
Right. Now, vouchers also have a dark side. I mean, in Australia, for example, you've had things like the cashless welfare card systems. I mean, those are essentially types of like voucher systems where it's like, you can use the Australian dollar, but you cannot use it on a bunch of things. That there's redeemability conditions being placed on it, right?
Mm.
So there's different like dynamics to voucher systems where you can basically place conditionality about where it can be used, on what it can be used, with who, and so on. And whether that's positive or not depends on the design and what your intention is.
That shows you how important the goal is, because obviously the goal with these cashless welfare, which I'm very opposed to, is about controlling the behavior of people who are receiving unemployment benefits.
Exactly, yeah.
Whereas the Brixton Pound is more about supporting your local industries.
Yeah, and it sort of depends on who's doing the issuing and what their agenda is, determines what the vibe of the particular voucher system is, right? Of course, like the Australian government saying we want to ring fence it for particular things is a different thing to a community group saying we want to try and prevent all the money going to big retailers that are sucking it back to rich shareholders somewhere. So there's different vibes to the voucher systems, but they have a similar structure in that they're basically sort of tethered into the main monetary system. Now, if you want to detach from the main monetary system, rather than being tethered into it, you can look at things like mutual credit systems or time banks or basically any kind of credit-based systems. And one great thing about those systems is they help people to learn about the principles of credit money, like MMT, for example. At some level, MMT relies upon an understanding of the fact that money can be created from nothing,
mm-hmm.
right? It's spent into existence. It's issued into existence. And that's quite a hard thing for people to understand, because they tend to experience the world as money users, right? They experience money as something that comes from somewhere else, and they sort of try to grab it like squirrels and sort of hoard it. And so there's a particular mentality in society about what money is supposed to be. So it's hard when you try to get people to understand the other side of the monetary circuit, which is the issuance part, that there are people who have the ability to push it out. And they often feel moral horror at that the idea that you could just sort of spend money into existence. They say, like, how could that be?
It's made a lot harder when the mainstream story is that money comes from taxpayers, which is exactly the wrong way around.
Yeah, well, they're trying to pretend that the state's like a giant squirrel trying to collect acorns too.
Yeah.
Rather than an oak tree that issues the acorns.
Oh, it's the oak tree, yes.
That metaphor has its own problems as well. But like
the magic oak tree.
You know, but like... This is a big problem if you're designing an alternative currency. So, you know, something like, for example, a voucher-based local currency like the bricks and pound didn't have this problem, because money appears to people in the same way. It's like a voucher. It's like an object that comes from somewhere and you suddenly can pass it around. If you ask them to enter a mutual credit system, it becomes much harder, because you're asking them to become money issuers.
Oh, okay.
Right? Or a time bank for that matter. So you say, okay, what's going to happen here is we'll all start on zero. You all have nothing, and then you can dip negative, but you dipping negative will make somebody else go positive. Now, when you're dipping negative in a mutual credit system, let's say you're getting labor from somebody, you're going to go negative. What you're basically doing is you're issuing money.
You're in deficit, yeah.
All right? You're issuing IOUs, credits to them, saying, I got something from you, and I will redeem something back when you come back with those credits to me. You become a money issuer, all right? Now, the thing about a mutual credit system is what happens is that sort of gets socialized, so you can kind of have a network of credits where you go out of balance to somebody else, and then they pass the positive credit to somebody else, and the other person comes back to you. So you have the sort of horizontal network of credit. And at any one point, there'll be some people in positive and some people in negative. And the ones who are in negative are the money issuers. And the ones who are positive are the ones who are using them. But it's always fluctuating.
How do you stop someone from just being an issuer?
Well, that's the big design questions. You'll put credit limits. So the central administrators of mutual credit systems will place limits on how much you can go into deficit, because, you know, you'll get some freeloader who rocks up, gets a bunch of stuff from people, and then just buggers off and doesn't actually redeem the credit.
Mm-hmm.
The other problem actually is the problem of recessions, where essentially you'll have a bunch of people who accumulate their credits and then won't use them. So they're basically stopping other people from exiting deficit. You know, so if you're stuck in deficit, you have to have other people coming back to you to
reciprocate,
pay you for something.
Yeah, experiencing these systems is quite an interesting experiential way of understanding the basic dynamics of credit money systems, which then in turn enables you to understand the much larger operations of a much larger scale state banking credit money system. Because in many ways, the state and the commercial banks is the big, like, negative number in our massive monetary systems, right? Half of the point of the MMT movement is to say stuff like, actually, the deficit's not a problem, because it's what creates the sort of private sector assets, right?
We say it all the time.
Like, that's basically like a massive, large-scale version of a mutual credit system.
And so have you been part of a particular mutual credit system then?
I mean, I've tried over the years, but again, there's small-scale systems and it's hard. But there are good examples of them. So, for example, there's a friend of mine who runs one in Sardinia, which is quite well-known, called Sardex. And it's on an island. So there's a certain kind of defined economy there. The way he did it was actually very clever, because he could approach small businesses and say, oh yeah, I understand that you're going to spend most of your time in the euro system, but you can commit spare capacity that you have to this alternative system. So when there's problems in the main euro economy, you have a sort of alternative to sort of switch to. So it becomes like a kind of counterbalance to the standard system. And so people would find it quite useful. And they also would find it like a new way to get clients, a new way to meet other businesses they previously didn't know about. So he did it in a smart way. Whereas, of course, there are some systems where they maybe have a more moralistic way of doing it. They say, you know, you should be in my local exchange trading system, and it's hard for people to sort of understand like why they should be in it. So there's better and worse ways of building those types of systems.
Right, where he's talking about spare capacity, where whatever you're producing, it's not being sold, and therefore you're meeting the need to sell that with another way of creating a market around it.
Yeah. And actually, again, these types of small-scale credit systems, I mean, not only are they connected back to the stuff around economic anthropology I was talking about, where anthropologists for a long time have known in pre-capitalist communities, you'll find these much more sort of small-scale informal credit networks. And large parts of the MMT project is how do you get people to stop imagining that money is a commodity and that it is constrained, right? And how do you get people to understand that the real constraint is actually ecological systems and human labor? And actually, if you have those in place, you can use credit systems to unlock that type of stuff. So when MMT economists say things like the real constraint in the system is actually inflation, they're basically saying stuff like, if there is spare capacity, you can issue new money into that situation and you can mobilize stuff. If there isn't, it's not going to do anything. It's like sending, you know, I'm mixing metaphors again, but it's like yeah. It's like sending nerve impulses into an exhausted arm. Okay. You know, it's too tired to move. So the nerve impulses aren't going to do anything. They don't have any purchase upon the muscle. You know, if there's underlying capacity, the sort of fundamentals are there, you can actually create new money in that situation. So similar with these types of mutual credit systems, they'll say, hey, the mainstream financial sector isn't paying attention to what we actually have in our immediate environment.
Mm.
It doesn't care. You're not profitable enough to actually be dealt with or something, but we have our own types of resources here. We have, quote unquote, spare capacity in our system, and we can mobilize it ourselves with our own types of small-scale systems. And also, these small-scale systems will be less prone to crisis and inequality, and they'll have a different vibe to them. So this is what those movements often try to do.
Speaking of crises and inequality, putting your anthropological hat on, given the level of global inequality at the moment and the history of inequality previously, which resulted in revolutions, we're talking about, say, the Russian Revolution, the French Revolution, etc., where instability enters the mainstream through inequality. How do you think we're positioned at the moment?
That's a big question.
Is revolution in the air, or is the system going to prevail?
Yeah, that's a very big meta question. There's probably people who are better positioned than me who actually study the current situation with inequality in the world. But my intuition is there is systemic limits being hit. You know, a capitalist system, it has an inherent tendency to expand and accelerate, but that can often outstrip the reality of the underlying people and ecological systems. And when it starts to hit limits, it starts to like fragment and like start shaking and gets all these like contradictions, right? So basically, if you're out on a frontier and there's lots of space to expand, actually you can have this systemic dynamism and it creates instability, but people find new things that they can do. So for example, like with technological stuff, when workers get displaced by technology, they're temporarily displaced and then they can go to the new frontier and find something new. They can expand. But if there's no more frontier, if you've hit the limits, what starts to happen is you just get unemployment. You know, you'll just start to find people who are systemically underemployed when you're hitting those limits. So the capitalist class are trying to automate everything because that's what they do to try and optimize profits. But there's no new jobs for the people being displaced by that to go into. So you start to have like fragmentation in your system. And I think that's probably starting to happen in our system.
You're listening to 3CR 855 AM on digital and on the internet. www.3cr.org.au.
You know, Kev, on that question of whether we should get rid of money because it's the reason the planet is on fire and it's the reason that so many humans are left in poverty, I sort of think that blaming money is a bit like blaming the messenger, because I don't think the problem is money, and I don't think the problem even is that we have markets. I think the problem is that we've got capitalism using money and using markets in certain ways.
Well, yes, okay, and I tend to agree with you. And as we said before, it's this hoarding thing, this squirreling away thing that Brett was referring to that seems to always interfere with the smooth operation of a monetary system. And this is kind of a side issue, but we've had the recent experience of Trump and his tariffs on China, et cetera. He's talking about this trade deficit that the United States have with China because China's got all the money. He seems to completely not understand that they've got all the stuff, that it was a two-way transaction.
Yes.
He says, we've been ripped off for years. You weren't ripped off, mate. You turned this thing with no intrinsic value that was created on a computer.
They've been giving us all this stuff for our digital bits and bytes.
Yeah, so the Chinese got all the numbers and the US got all the stuff, and he reckons that was a bad deal. Of course, what he's saying is that stuff should be made in the US and he's trying to increase his productive capacity, et cetera. But it's like this kind of this mentality of the capitalist who wants to squirrel away wealth. That's the objective. And they miss so much of the story, the monetary story.
Like Brett says, if we want to get to a society that doesn't use money, then everything changes. You know, you could almost imagine that we'd end up with anything from like a centralized totalitarian system where everything is rationed so you don't need money, or we could end up in these localized tribal groups where each of these groups are doing their own thing. And I guess I'm less interested in exploring a world without money because I suspect we need a massive population decline before we're going to return to a pre-monetary system. And if we did end up in that situation, I suspect the non-monetary systems would evolve organically. You know, you wouldn't even be intentionally designing that in any way, or maybe people would continue using centralized ledgers and they wouldn't recognize that they're using the beginnings of money if they do that.
I've been indulging in a bit of well, as far as I can see at the moment, all roads lead to Marx, Karl Marx, and I've been just dipping my toe into Marxism and having a bit of a look around. Uh-huh. It was interesting the kind of progression that he and Engels were identifying, where it went from tribalism to slavery, the ancient model, through to feudalism, through to capitalism. Mm. And you're looking at various degrees of exploitation, except in the tribalism model. Mm. There wasn't exploitation there. It's when you went into the ancient system where you had slaves and then the slaves became serfs and then the serfs became workers. There's always an exploitation there. Mm. And the conclusion that they came to was that socialism, being the next step, was one where we let go of the onus of private property. Mm. And this is where capitalism and private property go hand in hand. And Brett was talking about, if you're going to change the monetary system, you're talking about the nervous system of an economy, which is the distribution of resources. Mm. And to change the monetary system, you need to change the way we think. And that primarily seems to be around the idea of private property or public ownership. And because we're so entrenched with this idea of private ownership and accumulating private ownership and wealth, and we've moved further and further away from public ownership or sharing, mm. we're not accustomed to sharing. And until we start to take that on board, which was the original tribalism that we're talking about before the exploitation started occurring and capitalism evolved, it sounds like we almost have to go full circle back to that earlier mode of thinking where we share things. We don't try and hoard things. We share things.
Yeah.
And that might take some time.
You know, in the meantime, people like Brett have looked into how can communities create their own monetary systems. And, of course, it's very useful to understand how monetary systems work to do that. And he mentioned things like mutual credit systems, and I was trying to understand how much like a monetary system that we have now, say with the Australian dollar, how much like a national monetary system are they? Because they do have a central ledger that's keeping track of IOUs that people are making to each other, and they do allow these credits and debts to be universally traded. But on the other hand, I don't think they have like a central authority that is taxing in those credits. So I'm left wondering what is driving the value of a credit in a mutual credit system.
Yep. It's interesting because there's no central authority on that. And this is what we're identifying as taxation. In those systems of mutual obligation where I do something for you, you do something for me, there's a ledger kept on that. If somebody just opts in and then opts out before those obligations are balanced, it's of no consequence because there's no authority to regulate that. There's no police force backing up a tax office to clamp down on that behaviour.
Although he did say that they will have rules about how much into deficit, for example, that you can go. But I do sort of wonder what kind of longevity and stability these systems can have.
Well, you're depending on a lot of goodwill there because rules are made to be broken. And certainly you'd find if there is a little consequence to not meeting your obligations, you'll find opportunists bombing in and bombing out at will.
Yeah, that is always the problem.
Mm. Yeah, you need someone to go around and break legs to drive the point home. So.
Well, it seems like too that that's the same problem you see at an international level. Like I was thinking that these mutual credit systems, they seem more like a system of international trade where, you know, if you think of each nation state as more or less voluntarily taking part where there's no higher authority, then you do have those twin problems of either some nation hoarding their credits or other nations going too deep into deficit. And I think this is what the Bretton Woods system was trying to solve after the Second World War, and they created these international institutions like the IMF. But unfortunately, the real power relationships in the world sort of got involved and ended up not creating a fair international system.
Yeah, it's been very interesting watching first Russia and now the US break these agreements because you're quite right, the whole push after World War II was to have interdependent trade between nations and that was supposed to stabilize behavior because everybody depended on everybody else to get along. You know, we need this from you, you need this from them, they're going to give it to us.
We're not going to invade you and blow you up because we want you to keep making the stuff that we need.
It'll disrupt everything. And that was how it was supposed to work. Mm. You know, so they probably have some impact. It's just that, of course, some of these players have the right of veto and there's a power imbalance in the UN, and the UN's got all sorts of problems, and I'm nowhere near educated enough to start talking about it. But yeah,
you still got to figure out your marks before you get on to that.
Yeah, I got to finish the Communist Manifesto and then get on to Das Kapital before I start going into the history of the UN for the last 50 years. So there's exactly. A bit of work to be done.
Well, that was a really fun conversation that we had with Brett Scott. And we will continue our conversation with Brett in our next episode, where we will start to look at the issue of the use of cash in a monetary system and whether or not there is a war on cash.
Yeah, it was interesting speaking to Brett, as will be heard in our next episode, about the importance of cash, cold, hard, you know, coins and cash in your hand. I've been a bit ambivalent towards it. I just sort of thought, does it really matter that much? But the way he described it is probably the best way I've heard it described. So it's worth listening to the next show coming up.
Yep.
Because we go into that.
These issues around monetary systems, they might seem very esoteric and maybe the least of our problems. But I do feel that if you do want to build a better world, you do need to understand how money works.
But until then, Anne, I think we need to make some room for Mafalda coming up next. And skedaddle.
All right. I'll see you next time, Kevin.
See ya.
You've been listening to Radio MMT with Anne and Kev.
We'd love your feedback. Email us on radiommt@gmail.com or search Radio MMT on social media.
Listen to this show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or on 3cr.org.au www.3cr.org.au/radio-mmt.
Support this show and the station by subscribing to 3cr.org.au and mention Radio MMT.
We thank all our guests.
And we thank economist Professor Bill Mitchell and his mmted.org, educating masses on modern monetary theory.
And thank you to our listening listeners for listening. And I thank you, Kevin.
And I thank you, Anne. So what's planned for next week?
Kevin, there is still so much to talk about. We've got to expose all this rotten economics.
Well, that's good, and I get it. Do you reckon we could use a bit more music?
Well, I made a list of all these terrible economic theories. Like, have you heard of the theory of comparative advantage, or the quantity theory of money, or the loanable funds theory?
Have you heard of a band called Single Gun Theory? Like, they're a really good band. I'm sure there's a whole range of, like, macroeconomic music that I could bring into the show.
Yeah, but we really need to do marginal productivity theory, not to mention the natural rate of unemployment and the money multiplier.
You've got a pretty good singing voice. I play bass. Bill, he plays guitar. I reckon we could form a macroeconomic band. Like, we could deliver this whole message by music.
Well, we could call the band the Permanent Income Hypothesis, or the Ricardian Equivalent, or Rational Expectations.
I think we're onto something here. We're trying to make macroeconomics more interesting to the masses. We're going to, like, form this band and sing it to them. And we're going to bring the economists in. We're going to get musical.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.